Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, email, Google+, simple ways that you can share Issues Etc. programs with your friends, relatives, and fellow parishioners. Just go to Listen on Demand Archives at issuesetc.org and look for the share feature images posted beneath each audio segment. You're only one click away from telling someone about Issues Etc. The Listen on Demand page at issuesetc.org and look for Share This.
Do you believe in punishment for abortion? Yes or no, as a principle?
The answer is that there has to be some form of punishment.
For the woman?
Yeah, there has to be some form.
Ten years?
I don't know.
You take positions and everything else.
I do take positions and everything else. It's a very complicated position.
That's GOP presidential candidate Donald Trump and Chris Matthews of MSNBC's Hardball discussing penalties for abortionists and for their customers. Is Donald Trump right? Does there have to be some kind of punishment, however small, for a woman who seeks and procures an abortion if Roe v. Wade were overturned and abortion were illegal? Now, Trump, to be fair, has backed off those statements. He's backed off completely from those statements, but it did raise the ire of many pro-lifers who said, look, that's not a pro-life position, never has been. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Joining us to discuss that and some recent statements made by Hillary Clinton on the rights of unborn persons, Dr. Frank Beckwith. He's professor of philosophy and church-state studies at Baylor University and author of several books, including Defending Life, A Moral and Legal Case Against Abortion. Dr. Beckwith, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thanks for having me back.
In his initial statement made right there with Chris Matthews that there has to be some kind of punishment, is Donald Trump right?
No, he isn't. In fact, there are many of us who have written about this issue for years. In my book, Defending Life, I actually have an entire section dealing with the question of penalties given if abortion were to become illegal based on the fact that the fetus is a human person. And the interesting thing, Todd, if you go back and look at the pre-Roe world, and this is something that I'm sort of surprised nobody does. When abortion was illegal prior to the mid-1960s in every state under state and local homicide statutes, what's fascinating is that there were virtually no states or jurisdictions where there was a penalty for the woman. It was always for the physician, and the few places where there were penalties, there were very rarely, if at all, prosecutions. And there's a couple of really good reasons for this. One, you're talking about a crime that occurs in private, where the only witnesses are all participants, right? Who do you give immunity to in order to increase the number of prosecutions? Well, the one person that generally people believed was in a desperate situation and was doing something that they ordinarily would not do, namely seek an abortion. So this was the mindset and the thinking at the time. And the other thing we have to remember is that there's a difference between criminal statutes that forbid acts and the punishments that jurisdictions employ when they convict people or accuse them or attempt to remedy the problem. This is something that goes all the way back to Thomas Aquinas. I mention Aquinas because I'm actually teaching a graduate seminar this semester at Baylor on Aquinas' treatise on law, and it's really interesting. We were just going over one of his questions where he deals with the issue of punishment, and he says punishments, just like any other aspect of the natural law, have to be applied given cultural circumstances. And so there is this understanding, it's always been, even in the common law, that just because a particular crime may be heinous doesn't mean that all punishments should be equal. And the reason for that is that we believe that the purpose of law is not only to punish people, but also to make sure that there are fewer of those heinous crimes that occur in the future. If every participant in the abortion were subject to the same type of punishment, guess what would happen? There'd be few, if any, prosecutions, because nobody would be willing to testify without being granted some type of immunity.
So we're dealing here with what it sounds like a really a legal impossibility. Even if in principle you agreed that women should be punished, it would be nearly impossible to do this in an orderly way under a law, to even craft a law and
That's
proceed
right.
as prosecutors. But secondly, and I think this is the undercurrent of what you've been saying here, something recognized in the pro-life community from its very inception in the United States, is that women often, and I would say almost always, seek abortions under extreme duress, either from within or without.
That's right. I mean, we have to remember that that laws only work as well as the people that are under those laws. So, you know, taking into consideration our cultural situation where you have, you know, people have grown accustomed to the right of abortion. They may not have always people, I'm not suggesting that, you know, vast amounts of people have taken advantage of that, but a sizable number of our population has. And so given that experience, it seems to me that if you're going to make it illegal, that something has to be done in a way that makes sure that we have fewer abortions, but at the same time recognizes the historical reality that we're in. But also, if you go to, again, back to pre-Roe era, when abortion was illegal, it's clear that what went into the legislation was an understanding of the woman's plight as well as the gravity of the offense. And that's why the laws were crafted as they were. And as I said earlier, it's astonishing to me that I've been reading a lot of opinion pieces on this, how very few people go back to pre-Roe, which is you think, well, there was a time, in fact, where it was illegal. Let's see how they dealt with it then. And it turns out they dealt with it in ways that pro-lifers are suggesting it should be dealt with if abortion were to become illegal again.
And you're also emphasizing here, Dr. Beckwith, the overall goal of law, period, and that is not simply to punish crime, but to reduce incidents of crime like this, that overall goal of reducing the incidence of abortion sought even when they're illegal.
Well, if you think of a biblical angle on this, that's right. If you look at, for example, the way the punishments that that were in the law of Moses compared to, let's say, in the New Covenant, right? You know, there are different penalties given certain historical situations. Now, the wrong doesn't change. It doesn't. It isn't that adultery was, you know, is wrong at one point and right in another. No, but you can see it even in the way in which Scripture itself deals in both the old and new law in terms of certain types of activities. Now, the activities are not sanctioned, right? In other words, what was bad in the past is not now good, with the exception of the ceremonial law. But you find with the moral law doesn't change. What changes, at least is in terms of civil punishments, to be sure. But that doesn't mean the wrong becomes a right. And, of course, the historical situation is different. And as scholars have argued, biblical scholars, that there are reasons why those punishments were there for the Israelites and not for other peoples. But that doesn't mean that the wrongs are now right by any means.
Do we begin, because this question is always asked under the hypothetical scenario of the overturn of Roe v. Wade. And then assuming that there will be states where abortion will be outlawed outright. Mm-hmm. And that's a possibility, I guess, in the distant future. But do we begin as pro-lifers to think about ways to implement such laws that will punish in the extreme cases where some forms of abortion are actually illegal? Abortionists who carry out late-term abortions, partial birth abortions, where those are illegal.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's something that not only I think that we should think about, but pro-lifers, in fact, have made many suggestions. Americans United for Life, there's a gentleman there, a scholar named Clark Forsythe, who's actually written extensively on this. It's something that we have to think about if we reach that point, and it may very well happen. If the Supreme Court overturns Roe v. Wade, there will definitely be states where abortion will be illegal. It's not clear whether that the criminal statutes that had existed before Roe would simply not be amended in some way. So you may have situations where a state, let's say, for example, Mississippi, where I suspect abortion would become illegal, how legislators craft their statutes in terms of handling this situation is going to show, it's going to allow, I think, pro-lifers to be both compassionate in the way in which these laws are crafted, and at the same time use the law to teach of the grievous nature of the act.
Let's go to the phones and see what Harry, listening in Arlington Heights, Illinois, has to say. Harry, thanks for being patient.
Thank you very much. In this national abortion debate, the voices of interrogators, pundits, and candidates are noisily engaged in the futility of allocating reproach between the doctor and the patient. The futility is inevitable. Consequence of the Supreme Court's grant to the man to get out of a marriage free card 50 years ago, which decreed that ADC dollars went to the mother only if the man got out of the house. Faint attempts to enlist and enforce this masculine breadwinner, his responsibility is faltered or even defaulted, and the primary perpetrator of that problem now roams free, not even on the solution radar of the problem that he instigated. And there's an easy solution if we but had those in government with the backbone to adopt it. And here it is briefly. Reverse that free card law and then require every birth certificate to have the name of the father and where not married to the mother DNA verified at his expense, coupled with an absolute requirement for adequate support for the full minority of the child. And in addition to full enforcement provisions, failure forfeits Social Security for him, and if she fails to identify the perpetrator, for her as well. That'll take care of it.
All right, Harry, thank you very much. What do you make of it, Dr. Beckwith?
Well, you know, Harry, I think implied in his comments is something that I think is true, that a lot of what we're seeing today in our culture is the consequence of the breaking down of those legal bonds that were put in place to protect marriage. I tell this to my students whenever I teach constitutional law. We'll go over, before we go over some of the abortion cases, I will tell them that prior to the 1970s, and this really shocks them, in most states, a child that was sired by a father who wasn't the husband had absolutely no rights. And the reasoning behind the law was that it should be in the best interest of the child that he or she be brought up by two parents who are married to each other, and we're going to presume, it's called the presumption of paternity, that those two parents are the true parents of that child, and if another man comes along and he says, I'm really the father, then he said, well, the law would say, you're just not married to this woman. You are out of the picture. It was in the early 70s. There was an Illinois case that overturned that law in Illinois. And it basically meant that that child would have to now deal with not only the husband of his mother, but a third party that his mother had violated her vows with. You know, you can imagine now that this, of course, is now prevalent throughout our society, and this can't help but show that marriage is not thought to be quite that serious. I do think there's a connection between, the breakdown of marriage as and the law and those who have the responsibility of passing and protecting those laws, are to blame for this.
Dr. Frank Beckwith is our guest. He's professor of philosophy and church-state studies at Baylor University and author of several books, including Defending Life, A Moral and Legal Case Against Abortion. You can purchase this book at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. When we come back, another 10 minutes with Dr. Beckwith, we're going to take up the subject of Hillary Clinton's recent statement about unborn persons and their complete lack of rights. She doesn't seem to bemoan it at all, and she again pits the lack of rights of the unborn against the total rights of the mother. We'll hear from her and see what Dr. Beckwith thinks about it right after this.
Throughout the 50 days of Easter, sacred music for the world. LutheranPublicRadio.org. Listen 24/7 to sacred music for the Easter season. LPR, LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Would you like to help a college or seminary student attend the Issues, Etc. Making the Case Conference? You can purchase a conference scholarship for a contribution of $100 to Issues, Etc. You can donate online at issuesetc.org/scholarship. Or you can make your $100 check payable to Issues, Etc. Write Scholarship in the memo line and send it to Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234.
Smartest listeners in radio. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Even if your child has mild to moderate autism, learning disabilities, attention difficulties, or other learning challenges, he can receive a classical Christian education. The Simply Classical curriculum was created by Issues, Etc. guest Cheryl Swope, an author, educator with a master's degree in special education, and homeschooling mother of twins with special needs. The Simply Classical curriculum has become an answer to prayer for parents and schools. Visit classicalspecialneeds.com and save $5 with the coupon code LPR.
I'm not a Christian, but I listen to your show because actually you do have some interesting topics.
Here's a recent comment from the Issues, Etc. comment line.
You believe that there's not one error in the Bible. That's intellectually infantile. You also believe that Jesus is coming again. You promote extremely sexually repressive views.
The Issues, Etc. comment line. Available 24/7. 618-223-8382.
Have fun waiting for Jesus to return. Got news for you. He ain't coming back.
When or if does an unborn child have constitutional rights?
Well, under our laws currently, that is not something that exists. The unborn person doesn't have constitutional rights. Now, that doesn't mean that we don't do everything we possibly can in the vast majority of instances to, you know, help a mother who is carrying a child and wants to make sure that child will be healthy, to have appropriate medical support. It doesn't mean that you don't do everything possible to try to fulfill your obligations, but it does not include sacrificing the woman's right to make decisions.
This Democratic presidential frontrunner Hillary Clinton speaking Sunday with Chuck Todd of NBC's Meet the Press. We're talking about that with Dr. Frank Beckwith, professor of philosophy and church state studies at Baylor University. Dr. Beckwith, what, if anything, surprised you about Secretary Clinton's statement there on Meet the Press?
Well, one thing surprised, but did really surprise me, but she certainly doesn't have her husband's glibness, that's for sure. I mean, you know, I imagine how Bill Clinton would have answered that question, and he would have been much more careful. But there's several interesting things about it. One, she first began answering like a law professor. So under the law, under the Constitution, the fetus has no rights. Or she said the unborn child, which is interesting.
Yeah,
she didn't
person.
Use the euphemisms of sort of the pro-choice movement. You know, she uses this language. She uses the law professor language. But what I found interesting, though, is that technically it's not accurate. In many states, a fetus can inherit money. You can actually sue on behalf of an unborn child in some tort cases. So she's not entirely right about the fetus having no rights. The other thing I found interesting is that she talked about the importance of the unborn child, and she also mentioned the obligations that the mother had. But if you have obligations to an unborn child, then wouldn't it follow from that killing it unjustly would be one of those obligations? It was fascinating to me. She referred to the fetus as an unborn person. Again, not using the euphemisms of the pro-abortion position, she just simply spoke as if as if she was using the vocabulary of her adversaries.
I found interesting also, at the end, she did have to, you know, issue her caveat that while, you know, her belief that the unborn person has no constitutional rights doesn't mean we're going to, you know, go off and do them great harm, although she's an advocate of abortion that does go off and do the worst harm to such unborn persons. But then she had to have a caveat at the end that, that also doesn't mean that it would be set against a woman's rights to make choices, rather vague legal term for, as you say, kind of the law professor mode she was in there. But it struck me at the end of her comments there, Dr. Beckwith, that she was essentially saying unborn persons, zero rights, women, total rights. What does that tell you?
Yeah, it was really, you know, I was telling this to a colleague. We were talking about this the other day, and I said, it's interesting that somebody who holds her positions, held it all her life, had no ready answer. It seemed to me she was kind of caught off guard by it. And because it was clear that if she had prepared for it, she would have not used language that really upset people on her side. There were many people that said that the fact that she referred to the fetus as an unborn person is clearly, you know, not the sort of language that they want to hear, right? They want us to use kind of more clinical, dehumanizing language. But yeah, and then the language, it talks about how important it is for us to use all our power and our resources in healthcare to make sure that child is healthy. And I thought to myself, well, in that case, you're treating the child as if it is intrinsically valuable, that it is the sort of being that requires that we employ enormous amounts of money to safeguard and protect. And yet, of course, at the very end, she says, but that doesn't mean that the fetus is not something that the woman can destroy for her own interest, which means that it is both priceless and worthless at the same time, which is, it's just fascinating.
I wonder whether or not a perfect follow-up might have been, well, so that unborn persons have no constitutional rights, can you please tell me, Secretary Clinton, what other kinds of persons have no constitutional rights besides the unborn?
Yeah, I think she would at that point probably said, well, I didn't mean to use the word person because by saying that, you know, we most ordinary people think, well, if a being is a person, then it has rights. it was a very strange moment. It was revealing. I mean, I think it shows that it shows something else, Todd. That I think that it reveals that, I think this is maybe true of people on both sides of the aisle, is that when you're around, when you always surround yourself or always listen to people who agree with you, you're sort of not prepared to respond to questions that come at it from an angle that you're not accustomed to hearing about. So, you know, something to be said for, you know, politicians to actually hear from people who may disagree with them.
Dr. Beckwith, before we let you go, congratulations on becoming a visiting professor of conservative thought and policy at the University of Colorado next school year.
Oh, thank you very much. Yeah, I begin next fall, and I'll be teaching in both semesters, and I'll be teaching a course in philosophy and religion and team teaching a course on Thomas Aquinas with Professor Bob Pasnow. But yeah, thank you very much.
Dr. Frank Beckwith is professor of philosophy and church-state studies at Baylor University and author of several books, including Defending Life, A Moral and Legal Case Against Abortion. Dr. Beckwith, thank you so much.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Tomorrow on Issues Etc., we're going to review the movie God's Not Dead 2. Pastor Ted Giese will be our guest. We'll have our weekly interview with Terry Mattingly on media coverage of religion. And we'll find Christ in Isaiah chapter 65 with Pastor Brian Ketchelmeyer. Have you registered yet for the Issues Etc. Making the Case conference coming up this summer? It is coming up very soon, June 10th and 11th. Attendance for the conference is limited to 400. I watched the conference registrations come in daily. So if we are on track, and we are on track a little bit ahead of last year, we will reach 400 before the conference. So you need to register as soon as possible. Find out more at issuesetc.org. Register there as well if you have any questions at all about the Issues Etc. Making the Case conference. You can give us a call, 618-223-8385, 618-223-8385. It's the Issues Etc. Making the Case conference, June 10th and 11th this summer in Collinsville, Illinois. That's just about 15 miles east of St. Louis. What is it, the Dr. Seuss book, Horton Hears a Who? Remember the line that keeps getting repeated over and over there in that book? A person's a person, no matter how small. Now, she didn't mean to admit it, but she did. The truth that everybody knows, that no matter how small, no matter where they're located, unborn persons are persons and have rights. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
Cradled in historic Perry County, Missouri, the manger of the Missouri Synod, Emmanuel Lutheran Church at 453 Northwest Street in Perryville proclaims God's Word and celebrates His Supper on Saturdays at 5:30 and Sundays at 7:30 and 10 using the church's liturgy contained in Lutheran Service Book, enriched with ancient and modern hymns. For more information, call 573-547-8317 or visit www.emmanuel-perryville.org.
Is the law the opposite of the gospel? I've written an article in the latest Issues Etc. journal titled, Is the Law Bad? Some Myths About God's Law. You can read it by subscribing to the online Issues Etc. journal. Just click the red subscription button in the right-hand column at issuesetc.org. You can also read about Tim Wood's journey from many different Christian confessions to the sound and seamless theology of the Lutheran Confession, the free online Issues Etc. journal.